Then hello to this week's string seminar. And we have, I guess, kind of back at PI, but only virtually, Sebastian Mizera, who's at IAS, and he's going to talk to us about crossing symmetry in the planar limit. So please take it away.
Okay, so thank you, Dominic, and thank you for the invitation to give a seminar today. The way that I wanted to start is with a historical remark. This year, 2021, marks the 80th anniversary of the very first Feynman diagram. Okay, here's how it looked like in a very old-fashioned notation. And it appeared in this old obscure paper of Stueckelberg in 1941. However, that wasn't the most exciting part about this paper. What he also shown in the same in the very same paper, he made a revolutionary at the time observation that free electrons are indistinguishable from free positrons moving back in time. Okay. So here's the picture and the notation that I will be using in this talk. There's some electron with a definite energy and momentum, and the claim is that it's indistinguishable in a sense from a positron with the opposite energy and the opposite momentum. Now, what you might wonder is whether this statement translates to quantum theory. So in quantum field theory, what we need to do is we need to phrase it at the level of observables. Okay, so you can devise a sort of a Gedanken experiment in which you consider this electron and you probe it, you measure it in some experiment, like so. So you scatter it with some particles, and then you can consider another experiment in which you consider the positron, or in fact any antiparticle, going back in time, and measure it in exactly the same experiment. And the question is, are these two indistinguishable? And for this to be really physically meaningful, what you want is that this fact that these two are indistinguishable should be independent of the way that you observe it, and in particular, independent of the number and the type of the remaining particles in the scattering process. So this translates to a conjecture called crossing symmetry. And the more concrete question that it asks is whether the two scattering amplitudes, this one and this one, are really boundary values of the same analytic function. Okay, so it was proposed by Gell-Mann, Goldberger, and Fearing in 54. So now you can ask yourself, well, how are we really supposed to think about crossing symmetry? Because after all, this is the picture of how it looks like in momentum space. We have one process supported in the future light cone, here with some momentum P, and another process supported in the past light cones, in the past light cone. And both of them are really defined on the mass shell, meaning that the square of the momentum is equal to some constant, which we call the mass squared. So crucially, these two regions in the momentum space are disconnected from each other. So what we need to do is we need to complexify the momentum space. Once you complexify the momentum space, you land on a picture looking something like this, on a very cartoon level, in which scattering amplitudes now become multivalued functions with a host of new singularities in these complex spaces. And they're multivalued. For example, the simplest examples would be some kind of log branch cuts, which once you continue it to complex parameters become have monodromes. So these singularities, as we'll explain in the rest of the talk, corresponds to saddle points in the word line formalism, this in perturbation theory. So crossing symmetry at this level will have to explain how to navigate around any such singularities to somehow continue the momentum starting from the support in the future light cone to the one in the past. Okay, so we'll need to find some path of analytic continuation that cleverly avoids all possible singularities and allows you to continue the function from one to the other. So there has been a lot of work in attempting to prove crossing symmetry non-perturbatively in the last century. And I can summarize it basically on one slide, the results of those investigations. Is that under the assumptions of microcausality, locality, entirety, as well as the mass gap, we know that we can continue between these two processes. So we can select two special particles in a 2-to-2 scattering process. say one and four, and then continue smoothly the momenta such that the particle one becomes the antiparticle one bar, and likewise four becomes four bar. So that's an important result of Gross, Epstein, and Glasser, which later was around 20 years later was also generalized to free scattering, which looks exactly in the same way. Okay, so at this stage, you can ask yourself, well, why don't we learn about these results in a PSI quantum field theory course? And basically, there you can distinguish between two types of reasons why we don't do that. First one is that these proofs that go into sort of proving these kind of statements are really not physically illuminating. So roughly speaking, how they work is that you start with a position space correlators, then you apply the LSZ procedure. Once we know that we apply an LSZ procedure, we know that we're in trouble because they don't compute scattering amplitudes. Instead, they compute off-shell Green's functions, so which are not observables. And then the whole trouble in showing crossing symmetries to translating the properties of the off-shell Green's functions into properties of on-shell scattering amplitudes. So these crucially require a lot of theorems in complex analysis in several variables. And the problem with this strategy is that all of the physics assumptions, the physical assumptions such as causality that I mentioned above, are sort of inputted at this stage, but all the meat of the proof is at this stage in which you do these manipulations using holomorphic extension theorems. Okay, so this is not fully satisfactory because this is the difficult part of the proof, and basically it doesn't rely on the physics, it's mostly a mathematical proof. Okay, and secondly, the second reason that I would like to emphasize is that these proofs are highly technically complicated, and so much so that they have never been carried out in many physically important situations. So let me highlight some of the very simplest cases in which we don't really know if crossing symmetry actually holds as a property of some basic axioms of quantum field theory. And this would be any process involving massless particles, such as the ones that we see in the world. Secondly, any process involving different number of in and out states. So for example, if you consider this scattering of particle 1, 2 into 3, 4, 5, and you want to exchange this particle into an antiparticle 3 bar, it has never been proven if such a thing, such an analytic continuation exists. In particular, the dream of Stueckelberg that the particle and antiparticle are indistinguishable from each other has never been realized. And finally, what has been never attempted, or rather what has been never completed, is the proof of crossing symmetry when you have more than five particles. And that's important because once you have more than five particles, the constraints coming from the space-time dimensionality start mattering. So we'd like to know that as well. Okay, so the bottom line is basically we need a better approach. Okay, and I think this is a very important problem, and I'm sure there's a lot of ideas of how to approach this in the audience, so I would love to hear about them after the talk. But for the purposes of this talk, the main idea would be to prove crossing symmetry within the framework of perturbation theory. So that will be the simplification. We'll now go to perturbation theory, we'll do Feynman diagrams. Okay, and there we might reasonably hope to circumvent the issues that I mentioned above. So the main point about going to perturbation theory is that now we'll have clear physical meaning of the singularities, and singularities will correspond to the saddle points on the world line. And they also have the interpretation as intermediate particles, intermediate exchanges going on shell. Okay. Moreover, in perturbation theory, we have standard ways of dealing with UV or IR divergences, like it or not. At least it's a progress compared to non-perturbative physics, in which there's no analog of that. And finally, we have the same rules for any multiplicity. So basically, the upshot of that is that whatever we argue at multiplicity 4, 2-2-2 scattering, the exactly the same proofs, or more or less the same proofs, will carry out, will be generalized to higher multiplicity. And because of that, for the purposes of this talk, I will focus on 4-point scattering mostly. Okay, so this will allow us, basically following this strategy, will allow us to, first of all, identify the types of singularities that can pose a potential obstruction to crossing symmetry. And then specifically, in the planar cases, we'll explain why those singularities do not exist in planar scattering processes, thus proving crossing symmetry in those cases. So you might, of course, going to planar processes is an additional simplification. So you might complain about that, but will still work to all loops, to all multiplicities with any masses and spins. So it's still quite a general result. Okay, so here's how it's going to work. What we're going to do is we're going to consider an amplitude in a given scattering channel of some AB scattering to CD. And then what we'll show is that provided that the original amplitude exists, the amplitude in the cross channel, like so here, will also be given by analytic continuation of the first one. Okay, so here the notation is that I have many particles and I split them into two non-empty sets, A and B, like so. And I have that for incoming states, and for outgoing states, I split them into sets C and D. And then what's going to happen is that we're going to continue the scattering amplitude in this channel to the one in this channel. So they will be equal as functions, or rather as boundary values of a singular analytic function. And basically explaining exactly what this equal signs means will be the content of this talk. But before diving into more technical results, let me just illustrate what's going to happen on a cartoon level. Okay, so what we're going to do is, let me explain this diagram here. What we're going to do is consider some Feynman diagram with planar amplitudes. And then we consider sort of a five-step procedure, which will allow us to continue this Feynman diagram to this one without encountering any singularities. Okay, so what's the way that you should think about it is in some kind of light cone coordinates in which there's some positive and negative axis in the light cone here. And I split my incoming states into sets A and B, and the outgoing ones into C and D, such that they have a planar ordering A, B, C, D. Then in the first step of the analytic continuation, what we're going to do is we're going to adjust things within the light cone for these in states, such that the result of that continuation will be that the B states will be now closer to the positive side of the light cone as a result of this, closer to the positive side of the light cone than A. Okay, so basically these two will be now aligned. And in the second step, what we're going to do is now we're going to take these two states, B and C, and we're going to rotate them in the complexification of the light cone. As a result of which, we'll end up with C, particles in the set C will become antiparticles in the set C bar, and likewise, particles in the B will become B bar. Okay, so these will be the two distinct steps. These ones, rotating things within the light cone, and then rotating things from the future to the past and vice versa. And the rest of the steps will be just copy and paste of the same procedure with just permuted labels. So in this step here, three, we're just going to rotate these two groups, A and C bar, such that they're permuted like so. This will allow us to look at these in the sort of closer to the positive side of the light cone, then rotate them like so, such that A becomes A bar, B becomes B bar. And in the final step, what we're going to do is we're going to untwist the Feynman diagram and we're going to land on this. So the result of this is that now we used to have incoming states A and B and outgoing C and D. As a result of the analytic continuation, we'll end up with incoming states A and C bar, the antiparticles, and outgoing D and A bar, such that they still preserve the planar ordering. Okay, so let me emphasize that each diagram here represents a configuration. So if you have to do a path integral over all such configurations, and each diagram here means exactly that you cannot have singularities along the way of deforming performing this analytic continuation. So now this is a one step which will allow us to basically prove this identity that you can chop your set of incoming states and outgoing states and rotate them in pieces. And one application of that is that what you can do now is say for this as an example, you can consider this 2-to-3 process and then group it in the sets A and B and C, D, and so on, continue to this one and carry on. And you can check all the transitions. The result of that procedure after you apply it 3 times will be that you can connect the process involving 1-2 scattering to 3-4-5, as well as 5-bar 1-2 scattering into 3-4. So this one includes particle 5. This one includes the antiparticle 5-bar, and with all the remaining states unchanged. And that is exactly the crossing symmetry in the way that I defined it at the beginning. By the way, please feel free to interrupt me with any questions if anything is not clear or if you would like to hear more details. Okay, so for concreteness, let us focus on the simplest case of 4-point scattering. So in this case, our sets A, B, C, and D will be just each single particle each. So we'll have 1, 2, 3, and 4 in each of the sets. And what I wanted to translate to is into a Lorentz invariant content of this procedure. So in the 2-to-2 scattering, we have two Mandelstam invariants, two kinematic invariants, S, the center of mass energy, as well as T, which is the momentum transfer squared. And the procedure looks as follows. We can look at what happens. This diagram illustrates the real S and real T, so the physical values of kinematic invariants. And then there are 3 regions in this space, the S-channel physical region corresponding to this kind of scattering. This is the U-channel scattering region, physical region, like so. And this is the T1. So what we want to do is go from S to U to T. And then what's going to happen is that we're going to start with some well-defined amplitude defined in some open set close to a physical region. And the result of the first transformation, the one that was within the light cone, is that we're going to remain within the same physical region, same S channel, but on the way, we might be crossing some singularities. Okay, so what we'll have to learn is how to go around those singularities and then come to some place here. Okay, once we are here, we're going to start deforming things in the complex directions. And we'll see that the result of that is that T, the momentum transfer, stays constant and negative. And the only kinematic invariance that will be deformed is the S, center of mass energy. What this will allow us is to continue in the upper half plane, like so here, to land us in the U channel. And once we know these 2 steps, we only know this step and this step, and the rest is basically the same up to permutations of labels. You can travel within the U channel region, then you can continue from U to T, and then you can go to arbitrary point in that region as well, thus proving crossing symmetry between scattering processes of this type, and these in the planar cases. So I should emphasize at this stage that in the case of n equals 4-point scattering, the analytic continuation can be actually formulated in a simpler way. You can ask me about that afterwards. But this is the one that has the physical interpretation in terms of what happens in terms of 4 momenta. It also is the one that generalizes to arbitrary multiplicity. And I really hope that this has a chance of working for non-planar amplitudes. And that's why we describe this procedure. Okay, so here's the outline. What's going to happen is that I'm going to first review the Landau equations, or the saddle point equations that tell us about how to identify singularities. Then I will tell you about a special property of planar diagrams, in particular how the energy has to flow through the propagators of this diagram on a singularity. And then we'll explore the analytic continuation close to the physical regions. So the one that was here. And in the next step, we'll explore the analytic continuation in what I call crossing domains, which are the complex directions. And then we'll put finally everything together in the last part of the talk. So the conventions will be quite standard. We'll use the P to denote momenta, and the outgoing momenta will be denoted with an additional minus sign, such that the overall momentum conservation can be simply written as this. And the on-shell conditions will be given by these constraints, where MI, capital MI, is the mass of the external particle. And I will be working in the mostly minus signature. Okay, so in order to make the question of crossing symmetry well posed at the beginning, what we need to know is that the amplitude exists in the first place. And that means that it has to be free of any overall divergences. And we know that in perturbation theory, what we can always do, we can renormalize them or regularize them using our favorite scheme, such as BPHZ or dimensional regularization. So we'll assume that that has already been done. Then, in a CPT invariant quantum field theory, which admits local quantum Feynman rules, the scattering amplitudes are linear combinations of Feynman integrals. Okay, so here's the, let me just flash it so that I can explain the notation. Here we'll have some loop momentum integrations where D, here capital D, is the space-time dimension, and L, capital L, is the number of loops. Then in principle, here we can have some numerators coming from some vertex contractions, but at the beginning, I will consider only the scalar case. We'll see that this is the most offensive one, so we'll study necessary conditions for singularities in these cases. And the rest of the integrand is simply given by the propagators. So capital E will denote the number of internal edges in your Feynman diagram, or the number of propagators. And the notation is that we have IH bar upstairs, and downstairs we have QE denotes the momentum flowing through some edge E. If we have an edge E, it has a momentum E. Sorry, QE and the mass M sub E. Okay, and we add the I epsilon as usual. So of course, at every vertex, we have this momentum conservation that the external momenta entering at the vertex have to adapt plus the ones which are internal have to adapt to zero. Okay, and then the standard procedure here is to introduce the Schwinger parameters, alpha sub e. So every propagator can be expressed using the Schwinger trick, using this integral, where alpha e here is the Schwinger parameter. And from this perspective here, in the exponent, we have the I epsilon, which together with this I guarantees that this integral converges at infinity. Okay, so now applying this procedure to every single propagator, what we end up with is the same integral as we've seen before. Now we have E additional integrations over the Schwinger parameters, and we end up with some big exponent. Okay, so a big exponent has some I epsilon pieces, as well as this function here, which I will call V. So V here simply is just the result of doing this Schwinger trick exactly E times, so it's a sum over these quantities. Now, what you can study is you can study what happens in the classical limit. So as h bar goes to zero. So for now, let's ignore boundaries and just focus on the saddle points in this classical limit as in the bulk of the integration domain. So first of all, we just need to vary this v with respect to the loop momenta as well as the Schwinger parameters. So when we vary with respect to the loop momenta, because here we had Q, which were the internal momenta that are linear in the loop momenta, once we vary that, we get a constraint of this form that around every loop of the diagram, what you need to do is that the edges around this loop, the momenta of those edges times the Schwinger parameters up to the orientation signs, they have to add up to zero. Okay, so very simple. And then we can also vary the alphas, the Schwinger parameters, and that gives us a very simple constraint that this quantity here has to be zero. And of course, that constraint is the putting the particle E associated to this edge on shell. Okay, so these together are known as the leading Landau equations, and they themselves give you necessary conditions for singularities of any Feynman diagram. Okay, so like here, let me summarize it. We have a momentum conservation at every vertex, then we have this continuity law at around every loop, and then for every edge, we have this on-shell constraint. So what we can do is we can, or I always find it convenient to split the problem into linear part in the quadratic part. So the linear part are these two equations because they're linear in the momenta of the particles involved. And the quadratic part is the one that is, has the square. So the strategy will be to first solve, because we have a linear problem, we can solve it exactly. And then what we wanted to do is, for the purposes of proving analyticity or crossing symmetry, is we want to constrain where singularities can be. So we'll solve the linear equations exactly, and then we'll use that to constrain the quadratic part of the equations and show that they cannot be satisfied. So if I wasn't behind on time, I would also explain the boundary cell points, but basically the conclusion here is that they're already either included or they're not offensive for our purposes. At any rate, what we can consider, what we can do now is we ended up with a Gaussian integral in the loop momenta, so we can just integrate out the loop momenta. Okay, so we used to have an integral of the L's, now we just integrate it out. And the result of that is that we have an integral purely in terms of Schwinger parameters, alpha, with some Jacobian u raised to the power of the dimension divided by 2 times this exponent. And because the exponent is now evaluated on the Gaussian saddle point, we know that this action v has to have take this quantity v has to take the same form as before, but now evaluated on these Gaussian saddle points, so evaluated on these linear Landau equations. And at this stage, it's rather clear that inclusion of any spin interactions, you can show that if you go through this procedure, you will end up at most with some numerator here. So that numerator can easily remove some singularities, but it cannot introduce new singularities. And since we're interested in the necessary conditions for singularities, the scalar case is the one that is the most the singular in this sense. Okay. Okay, so we ended up with this form of the given contribution to a scattering process. And at this stage, this function v is purely a function of the Schwinger parameters as well as the Mandelstam invariance. It's a function of Mandelstam invariance because we know that the result is has to be Lorentz invariant. Okay, and then you can, if you're curious, you can also give explicit expressions for this u, for what this u is, and that has some explicit expressions in terms of spanning tree, basically combinatorics of the Feynman diagram, which will not be super important. But what will be super important is the fact that this v that we've seen in the exponent, this guy here, is nothing else than the word line action. So to those of you who know string theory, this will look very familiar, that we have the word line action, we localize all the fields, we end up with the finite dimensional integral over all moduli. Those moduli are the Schwinger parameters. They measure the lengths of the intermediate of the manifold here, which in this case is a one-dimensional graph. And what we end up with is that basically the action localizes to this quadratic sum over p dot p times the Green's function, which is a two-point function measuring the response to this diagram to the solving Laplace equations on the diagram, okay? When you perturb it around these 2 points. And we also have this mass terms for every word line. Okay? And then here we come to the crucial point about this way of thinking, which is that this action here is homogeneous. What this means is that when we dilate the diagram, so when we rescale the whole diagram by some scale lambda, like here, the reaction of this action is that it picks up some overall lambda times the action before rescaling. Okay, so it's homogeneous with degree one. The way you can think about this is that these Green's functions, we know that in one dimensional, when you solve for Green's functions in one dimensions, it, at least locally, it behaves linearly. So that already has this property. This also has this property. So at least it's if you haven't seen this before, at least it's plausible. And this sort of innocent looking fact has three very important consequences. First of all, we know that the consequence of that is that the action will actually vanish on the saddle points. So to remind you, the saddle point equation in this formalism was that the derivative of the action is given by this on-shell constraint for an intermediate particle. And because the action is homogeneous, this equation holds. So basically, as when you apply a dilation operator to V, you get the V back, okay, because it's homogeneous with degree one. And crucially, on the saddle point, all of these are zero, and that implies that the action itself has to be zero as well. Okay. Second important property is that because the Landau equations were essentially projective, they were independent of the overall scale of all of the lambdas. It means that we get E constraints, so as many constraints as the number of propagators. But now, because everything is projective, so defined up to this overall scale, it only puts constraints on E minus one variables. That means we have one additional constraint, and that one additional constraint will generically impose conditions on the external kinematics. And that's exactly what you expect from a singularity, like a resonance, because resonance doesn't happen in every point in the kinematic space. It only happens at special places. Okay, so that's given by this constraint. And finally, the deferred property is that what we can do is we can explicitly see what happens when you integrate out this overall scale. So let's just do a change of variables as you scale alpha with lambda. And what we've already seen is that the action scales homogeneously. You can show that this U, which is essentially the reduced determinant of the Laplacian, also scales with lambda to the L, where L was the number of loops. And the measure scales as this times the overall scale explicitly factored out. So this makes the integral proportional too. We can just integrate out this overall scale and see what happens. Okay, so you can collect all the powers of lambda from here, here, and here, and you can organize them here. Okay, so you have this factor where this coefficient gamma here is called the degree of divergence, and it's essentially equal to number of edges minus 1/2 number of loops times the dimension times the rest. Okay, and because the action was homogeneous, the lambda goes out here, then you can just do this integral. And when you do this integral, you get this result. Okay, so here where the I epsilon was very important, if we were away from the saddle point, this would be perfectly fine. But we've just found a second ago that on the saddle points, the action is zero. So you have zero plus I epsilon, and in this case, the I epsilon cannot save you, and you get a singularity. Okay, so therefore the word line saddle points are actually singularities. And historically, they've been referred to as anomalous thresholds. Okay, is there any question at the stage? Okay, so now we can discuss causality. Okay, causality has been so far imposed by inserting this I epsilon sort of by hand at the beginning. But the way that I will be thinking about this in the rest of the talk is as imposing the I epsilon by correct deformations of the contour or correct deformations of the external kinematics. And we know the invariant content of this procedure is that the effect has to be the same, meaning that you have to add some small imaginary part to the action V. So we can do it using the contour deformation or external kinematic deformation. And the requirement will be that the imaginary part of the action has to stay positive, strictly positive. Okay, so Let me move on now to an explicit example, and this example will also illustrate the energy flow in the planar Feynman diagram. Okay, so the example will be that of the box diagram. Okay, so here we have some external momenta p1, p2, 3, and 4, as well as the internal ones q1, 2, 3, and 4. Okay, so let's not worry about the red arrows for now. Work out what this factor u was. It doesn't matter that much for our purposes. What matters is that the linear Landau equations in this case are just imposing momentum conservation at every vertex. So there's four vertices and we have this momentum conservation. The momenta just adapt to zero, and around the loop what we have is that the sum of these q's times the relevant Schwinger parameters has to adapt to zero. Now you can solve this explicitly and you just get this solution. And at first, it doesn't look like it's very illuminating, but actually, let's look a bit closer. Okay, so what we can do is we can look at the energy component of these equations. So mu is equal to zero. And the reason why we want to look at the energy components is that here we have the external momenta, and we know that the external momenta have definite sign of the energy. So for example, for 1, 2, 3, 4 scattering, the energy of the particles 1 and 2 is positive, and the ones of 3 and 4 in our conventions is negative because it's in and out. Okay, so because of that, what we can do is we can look at what happens, say, to this edge. So Q2 was the edge here on the side, this one. And what we found is this solution. So we can now look at the numerator here. This quantity is positive. P3, the energy of P3, we're looking at the energy component. The energy of P3 is negative, so this is also positive. And likewise, this is positive. So what we find is that the energy of the second propagator is always positive, strictly positive. And likewise, what you can do is you can look at the fourth propagator here. This is negative, and this is negative as well. Okay, so what we found is that the energy in this edge and this edge, they have to flow in a specific direction. And moreover, that direction is dictated by the direction of the external momenta as applied to this diagram. And basically, on the sides of the diagram, the energy has to flow only in one direction. And this is not, you can check with the explicit solution even, that this is not the case for, say, these edges, in which the energy can flow back and forth. Okay, so what we found is that if there is a singularity, the energy on that singularity can only flow in the causal directions along the sides of a planar diagram. And this is, in fact, a completely general fact. Okay, it was just an example of a more general fact that if you have some big Feynman diagram and then you apply external momenta and they're arranged in this consecutive orders that all of the incoming ones are here or all of the outgoing ones are here, what you will find is that the energy along these sides here flows in the causal direction. There's many ways of understanding this. One of them is that now that we know that we're extremizing the action being extremized means that the total Lorentzian length of that diagram has to be minimized. So of course it would be not efficient if the energy was sort of flowing back and forth because this would not minimize the total length. And if you're curious, there's a very, very cool combinatorial proof of this fact that I will skip in the interest of time. Okay, so now what we're going to do is move to proving analyticity close to the physical regions. So that part of the talk doesn't assume planarity at all and it's completely general. So what we can do is we can look at the sort of energy plane, say, S, center of mass energy. And here the physical region could be somewhere along the real axis. Remember that the physical region is the one that corresponds to real energies. And as we know, close to these physical regions, we could have on it singular points such as branch points and non-singular points such as branch cuts. Okay, so here's one example. There could be some normal threshold, say. Okay. So what we can do is study the problem of analyticity sort of in the infinitesimal neighborhood of this point and infinitesimal neighborhood of these points. So let's start with the non-singular points. Okay, so close to non-singular points, what we can do is we can simply deform the integration contour. So what we're going to do is look at these word lines, and we're going to add a small imaginary part to these word lines. And it turns out that there's a canonical way of doing this, okay? All we have to do is do this change of variables in which alpha check the deformed Schrödinger parameter is just the original parameter times a small phase, okay? So this small phase here is going to be just I epsilon times this quantity that goes zero on shell for a given propagator. Now, because epsilon is small, we can just expand this. So to leading order, the change of variables doesn't do anything. But then we get a small, to subleading order, we get a small imaginary part, which is proportional to this quantity. OK. So now what we can do is see how the action reacts to these infinitesimal changes in the word lines. Okay, so the action, here's the deformed action. We just evaluated on this deformed Schrödinger parameter. And what we can do is simply Taylor expand it. Okay, so we Taylor expand it to leading order, we get the old thing. To first subleading order, we get just the strength of perturbation in each variable. Okay, so these are these points times the first derivative, of course. But we know that the first derivative is equal to exactly this on-shell constraint. Okay, so this, of course, just combines with that factor. So what we get is that the deformed action is just equal to the original one plus I epsilon times this quantity. And crucially, everything here is real, so this is always non-negative. Okay, and in particular, the imaginary part of the action, remember, imaginary part of the action is the thing that we want to keep positive to preserve causality. The imaginary part of the action here around non-singular points. Non-singular points are the ones that do not satisfy Landau equations. So we know that these things cannot be all zero simultaneously. And that tells us that this quantity here is strictly positive. Okay, so we conclude that for sufficiently small epsilons, this procedure exactly implements the correct causality conditions. And what is important here is that what we can do at the same time is we can not only do deformations in the Schrödinger parameters, we can also do deformations in the external kinematics, which are subleading to that. So because they're subleading, they would be hidden in these subleading terms here. Epsilon squared. And this means that everything I've said is still valid, even if we do small deformations of the external kinematics. So what this means is that we started with a picture looking like this, and then we studied the points, sort of non-singular points close to here. And what we found is that the amplitude is completely analytic in the small neighborhood of these points. Okay, so now what you need to show next is that you can also, what we haven't analyzed so far is the neighborhood of the singular points. It turns out singular points are a bit more subtle, so I'm going to skip the arguments here, but the bottom line is that now you can do both deformations of the Schrödinger parameters and deformations of the external kinematics. The situation here was that the contour deformations were the leading ones. Close to singular points is exactly the opposite. The contour deformations are subleading, and what matters is the kinematic deformations. And what it allows you to prove is that there's also analyticity, but only from a certain direction of the singular point. And after you run through the math, you find some constraints, and what it tells you is that you can also continue in some small neighborhood around these points. Okay, so what we've learned so far is the how to perform these blue continuations. So for example, here, we could have started with some point close to initial point, and then there's some target that we wanted to achieve. On the way of the, as we deform the kinematics, we could have encountered some singularities, some Landau singularities, some normal and anomalous thresholds. And what we've learned is that you can not only continue within here, you can also continue around those singularities using some small epsilon deformations. And what this allows us to do is come to some point here. Okay, so we're here. And now what we wanted to learn in this diagram is, first of all, what defines the endpoint of the step one and the first point of the step two, and moreover, how to do this complex deformation. Okay, so that leads us to the final part of the talk, which is proving analyticity in these crossing domains. Okay, so what we're going to do is first we're going to choose the appropriate Lorentz frame. In the Lightcon coordinates, so the coordinates will be this. There's some plus minus plus and minus coordinates along the positive and negative side of the Lightcon. And here's how I quote those components. And you can always choose a frame in which the plus and minus components of the particle one are equal to the negative of the plus minus components of the particle four. So they're diametrically opposed within the Lightcon. And likewise, for 2 and 3, we do the same. So we have minus P2 plus and minus P2 minus. Okay? And of course, we have to guarantee that this kinematics is non-singular in the first place, so they cannot be fully collinear. And that tells us the space-like components cannot be completely generic. Okay, and we'll of course impose Onshell conditions, which tell us that the masses have to stay constant and the momentum conservation. Okay, so here's how this situation looks like. We have some Lightcon plus direction and Lightcon negative direction, and we've just went to a Lorentz frame in which the particle 2 and particle 3 are on the opposite sides, and likewise for 1 and 4. And now what we're going to impose is that the particles 2 and 3, that one and that one, are closer to the positive side of the light cone than the other, than the remaining ones. Okay, so what you can do is measure basically this angle here and this angle, which is essentially just some rapidity, something like this. And what we're going to require is that these two, the angle is smaller. Okay, and this is exactly what's going to define the starting point of the second step of our analytic continuation. And we, of course, know what we wanted to do. So we wanted to rotate the energies remaining within the light cone. Okay, so what's going to happen is that we're going to take the momenta of the particle 2 and momenta of the particle 3, and we're going to deform them with a complex parameter z, or rather z. So we have this z, and it's introduced in such a way that it doesn't spoil the Onshell conditions. So the mass stays invariant because the light cone coordinates multiply. And also the momentum conservation is preserved because we deform these two in such a way that they adapt to zero. So now the goal of this deformation is that we started with the original kinematics, which was close to z equals 1. And then what we wanted to do is we wanted to change. So in this case, this energy is positive, positive, and this is negative, negative. And what we wanted to do is exchange them such that their energies become positive when they used to be negative and vice versa. So what we need to continue is between z equals 1 and z equals minus 1. And the way that we're going to do it is we're going to continue it in the upper half plane, in the z plane, at some radius larger than 1. Okay, so first, let's understand how this looks like in terms of Mandelstam invariance. And the way it looks like is that we can look at the what happens to the center of mass energy S, and as we deform it, it's equal to this quantity. So let's just look at the imaginary part of that. And after you do run through the computation, what you find is that everything is proportional to imz. Okay, we already know that imz is positive because we are in the upper plane. Times this constraint, okay? And then we are also in some radius larger than one. So this is smaller. And we also impose this constraint on the rapidities, okay? And the constraint on rapidities tells us precisely that this quantity is positive as well. So what we ended up with is that along the path of deformation, the imaginary part of the Schwinger of the Mandelstam invariant S is always positive. And likewise, what you can do is look at the momentum transfer, T, but that's much easier because we only deform these two momenta. Momentum transfer is the sum of these momenta squared, so it just does not get deformed. It's completely fixed. So if T was purely real to begin with, it's purely real during the deformation as well. Okay, so what this tells us that in the imaginary, if you look at the scattering process in the imaginary directions, it looks like a highly energetic process because all of the imaginary parts of the masses are zero, imaginary parts of the momentum transfer are zero. So the only scale is the S. So it looks like a highly energetic process, even though all the Mandelstam invariants are actually remain finite throughout. So now what we wanted to do is we wanted to show that Landau equations cannot have singularity, it cannot have solutions along this deformation, which is equivalent to saying that there's no singularities. So as promised, what we're going to do is we're going to first look at the linear Landau equations and explore their linearity. What their linearity tells us is that we can solve them for the internal momenta in the light cone coordinates. So these are the internal momenta associated to some edge E within the diagram. We can look at the plus minus components. Now, within the plus minus components, because of linearity, we can study what happens when you just apply momenta in this direction, P2, and also what happens when you just apply this momenta in direction P1. So because these equations are linear, the full solution is a superposition of the two solutions. Okay, so the first one is just going to be, let me just pull out the overall scale. So the overall scale is just P2 plus minus times these deformation parameters as we deform from past to the future, times some F. And the F is exactly what tells us about the flow of energy within the diagram as you apply this momentum. And likewise, what you can look at is the problem in this direction in which the GE tells you about the flow of the energies in this other component as you only apply momenta P1. Okay, so now what we wanted to do is this, let's say this is already solved. And now what we wanted to do is look at the on-shell constraints and prove that they cannot be satisfied. In fact, what we're going to look at is only at the imaginary part of the on-shell constraint. So the imaginary part of Q squared is given by this quantity. Okay, so you can go through the math, and what you find is that everything is proportional to imz times this quantity that we've seen before. This is, of course, not surprising at all, because we know that imaginary part of S is the only scale in the game, so everything has to be proportional to it. Okay, so we already know that this is, and this is positive, but now everything is proportional to S to F times G, which measure these flows. So of course, what we want to show is that these equations cannot be satisfied. But just for our purposes to understand what would have to happen if they were satisfied, let's say that this was actually zero. Okay, so if this was actually zero, either F has to be zero, G has to be zero, or both at the same time. Okay, so we have three options. And in the first case, F being zero tells us that this doesn't exist. And this would tell us that the internal momentum of the edge E would have to be purely aligned in terms of in this direction. Okay, so this would have to be purely aligned in the direction of P1. Likewise, if we had the other solution, it would have to be, this would disappear, so it would have to be purely aligned in this direction. And the final solution is that both F and G are zero, which means that the momentum in the light cone would be just zero. Okay, so in addition, using momentum conservation, what you find is that basically, if there was a singularity, no matter if its diagram is planar or non-planar, and the way that you would have to look like is that every single particle would have to be aligned every single internal particle would have to be aligned in this direction or be space-like. So basically, proving crossing symmetry is equivalent to showing that these singularities cannot exist. However, we already know that this cannot happen because of what we've seen before. Okay, so we can look at what happens to this momenta in the plus and minus light cone directions. Okay, so. And we can look at, for a planar diagram, we can look at what happens to the direction, to the flow of these positive and negative components along the perimeter of this diagram. Okay, so we already know that if we apply the momentum P2, just P2 and P3, and we look at how the energy flows, we've already learned that along the edges, it has to flow in a certain direction, here in this direction, like that. And here it has to flow in this direction. And likewise, if we only apply the momentum in the directions of P1, P4, like so, along the perimeter of the diagram, the energy has to flow exactly like this, and like this. And now the full problem is just the superposition of one and the other. So what this tells us that if you consider some edges here, on the edges of the diagram, of a planar diagram, then this tells us, for example, this as some edge somewhere here would have to have a non-zero component in this direction and non-zero component in this direction, which is in exact contradiction with what we just said, that it has to be either or. Okay, so along these perimeter edges, we know that the imaginary parts of the on-shell constraints have to have a definite sign. They flow in both directions at the same time, and therefore they can never be satisfied. And this is exactly what proves crossing symmetry in planar diagrams. There's one exception that you can study, which is the sort of called one vertex reducible diagrams, the ones that look like that, where the energy flow stops at some point. But these are as independent anyway. So if the amplitude was analytic to begin with, it's also analytic when we cross it. Okay, so in the final 1 minute, let me put everything together. So what we've learned is that we can perform a path of analytic continuation for planar diagrams, and it looks like as follows. The way that it looks is that we started with some Feynman arbitrary planar diagram, and then in the first step, what we've done is we started adjusting the external momenta within the light cone such that we remain in the same physical region, like so. And along the way, we could have encountered some singularities, but what we've learned today is that we can define them, we can deform around them using the small I epsilon deformations, okay? This allows us to go to the next step of the deformation, which was that once we align these two momenta to be closer to the positive side of the light cone, what we can do is we can start deforming it using this complex parameter Z. Okay, what this amounts to is deforming the kinematics in the complexified light cone. And then what we've just seen, because of the peculiar way that the energy flows along the propagators of the Feynman diagram, there cannot be on-shell singularity along the way, and therefore the amplitude is fully analytic. This allowed us to rotate B to B bar and C to C bar. Well, we've seen this in the four-point case, but you can trust me that you can go through exactly the same procedure, arbitrary multiplicity and the same story holds. And then in the third step, we just started repeating the same steps that we do. We did some IPSOM deformations to land on this configuration. Then we complexified the kinematics once again. This gave us this kind of configuration. And in the very final step, what we do is we rotate D and A bar, and we land on this configuration. And that process is the cross process of that. And the path of analytic continuation tells you that they're described by the same function, which can be freely analytically continued between one and the other, which shows crossing symmetry. So I think this is a good point to stop. So let me thank you for your attention.
All right. Thanks a lot, Sebastian, for this nice talk. I'd give it now to sort of the audience. So if somebody wants to ask questions, just unmute yourself.
Hi, Sebastian. Nice talk. Can I ask a question?
Sure.
When do you think a crossing could fail? Can you get some intuition rather than trying to establish when it works? When do you think it could fail? Or when do you think your analysis could lead to something that would be not be it works, but rather, for example, in different Simons models, crossing seems to be more subtle, mm-hmm. or maybe with different masses and more particles. Do you think would you imagine being able to find something that is surprising or where it would not work?
Yeah, absolutely. This is the reason why I wanted to identify precisely the type of singularity that could pose an obstruction. So now the question of proving crossing, at least along the specific path of deformation that I described, is equivalent to showing that certain class of singularities cannot appear. So if we to answer your question, at least in dimension 4 and higher, the answer to that would be basically equivalent to asking, is there a chance that for a given quantum field theory, such a singularity can appear? And of course, there's other answers to your question, which, as you know, in lower dimensions, we could also have other accidents, but these would be different mechanisms for forbidding crossing symmetry, such as the two-dimensional theories or the three-dimensional theories, transimons, like you mentioned.
So for example, insurance Simons, it was somehow related to the fact that you had anions, right? That you could have this crossing be non-trivial.
Yeah.
And there they could establish this crossing because they were doing some vector models, which were easy to study analytically, and then they could compute things and see how crossing would work. But I would imagine that if this phenomena is there, it would also be there for a joint theories with a planar limit where you could probably use techniques similar to what you have, but you do expect, I think, their crossing to be non-trivial. So do you think you would be able to... Is there something that we could imagine learning in those cases where we expect crossing to be non-trivial, right?
So you're thinking about just pure transimons or scattering of ions?
Transimons plus a joint matter, not vector matter, in the large N.
Yes, so they think what I, as long as far as I understand, they could be expanded in terms of local Feynman diagrams. And in this case, what I said just applies. So there's no subtleties.
I think crossing is, okay. Maybe I'm wrong, but I would expect that in some three-dimensional theories, because of anions, that crossing is a little bit non-trivial and that you pick up some non-trivial phases when you do crossing and that different channels get some different factors of gamma, sine gamma, that no one knows.
Yeah, so I already made an assumption at the beginning that CPT is satisfied, or strictly speaking, that each Feynman diagram by itself satisfies crossing. That is an important ingredient which needs a correction in transimons theories because we have these phases.
I think even in CPT invariant theories, for example, you can have, like in ABJM, you have transimons of level k with k and minus k, right, to restore CPT. And there, I think, and if I remember correctly, if you add mask to the matter and then scatter that matter, you have non-trivial crossing.
Okay, I would have to look at that. Is there which reference?
There are. I would recommend seeing, for example, check the talk of Minwala at Perimeter. He gave a nice talk where he explained. He tries to heuristically claim that discharged particles need to have some kind of Wilson lines that go to infinity to make sense of them. And then as you cross them around, you need to reconnect these Wilson lines, and this reconnection of discharged particles would produce some non-trivial factors. So in your pick, it should be like, you have this picture for the worldsheet, which is like some open strings, right? So the end points of the open strings, I guess, would have to be there will be some reconnection related to the endpoints of the open strings of your planar graphs that would produce some extra phases, I would imagine.
Yeah, I would have to look at that. As far as I remember, that was one of the examples in which perturbation theory, like expanding in pure Feynman diagrams, is not very, it obscures a lot of properties because you're expanding.
But I think you want to find the example. I mean, if each diagram is CPT invariant and crossing invariant and so on, you will be proving crossing symmetry for a trivial case, for cases there where you would be shocked if it was not crossing symmetric, right?
Yeah.
What's more interesting is when there is some surprise related to crossing symmetry, right? I would say.
I agree.
I think, yeah, those anions could be, maybe I would suggest that, a nice place to look maybe.
But I mean, I don't think it's really a surprise. I mean, the point is that if you have, you know, particles of this type, you have interactions that never turn off at infinity. You have topological interactions. So moving things around will give you braiding phases that you cannot.
My understanding was that those phases for a general N, that we don't know exactly what they are, right? This at large n, it's this sine of gamma and so on. But do we know how to predict exactly these crossing relations from first principles? I think Minwala was guessing what they were based on some large n two loop computation and seeing, oh, this looks like a sine of gamma.
I would be surprised that you cannot guess it from pure Trans-Simons theory. I mean, it's a braiding matrix of the anion, so it's a ratio of its matrices. But I mean, I haven't looked at it, but I think that there's a natural candidate for it.
Yeah, I don't think Davide is online, but once I discuss this with him, I think it's, yeah. I really think that, yeah, I don't remember this being trivial. So you say that for SU3, Schoen-Simons, or SU4, we would know how to predict this crossing transformation for these particles.
Well, you know that asymptotically you have a Wilson line with some representation R and some Schoen-Simons theory, and you know how those lines braid. Ratio of the modular matrices. But no, anyway. But you also assume you also assume that relativity here, right? So in a non-relativistic theory, this may have to be modified.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
I've not investigated non-relativistic theories. I'm actually not. I actually cannot recall any literature that would discuss something like this. Say for theories with Galilean symmetry, is that what you're thinking about?
Well, I think depends what there are many notions on non-relativistic, but I think if you have Galilean symmetry, essentially because you have particle number conservation, so in some sense there are no antiparticles.
Yeah.
You could have a theory that like Lipschitz theories that do not have Galilean boosts, and there you do have particle creation and all of that stuff. But I do not know. I mean, I may need to reconsider crossing symmetry there, even though, yeah. But you're not going to have boost invariants.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, for now, I'm mostly interested in sort of usual quantum field theories in four dimensions, just non-planar cases. So there's, as I reviewed at the beginning, there's already a lot of unanswered questions, and I guess what you would find surprising or not is a bit subjective. But I personally would like to settle the question of crossing symmetry, including massless particles, for example, which there's no evidence one way or another.
I mean, what would, so if you went away from the planar limit, I guess it's the first step, and and or to the massless case? I mean, what would technically change in your analysis? Or what would be like the main obstacles? I assume if you go away from the planar limits, or like the second part is not going to be as straightforward anymore.
Exactly. So I think in the way that I was phrasing the problem today, the masses didn't play any role. That's why I'm hopeful that it would just there will be meaningless to the way that I'm proving it. They were of course really crucial in the assuming the mass gap was really crucial in the analysis of the Brouse Epstein Glasser. The proof just breaks down at the first step if you don't assume it. So masses don't play any role. The, of course, planarity was really crucial to sort of explain why the on-shell conditions cannot be satisfied. And we know right now also about some classes of non-planar Feynman diagrams in which similar arguments can be made, but it's not clear if all non-planar diagrams can be explained using this way. We, of course, expect that the non-planar results at multiplicity for 2-2-2 scattering will translate to perturbative results, but it's not clear at higher multiplicity how this would work.
Let's see. All right. Let me stop the recording.